Welcome to the Minimum Viable Podcast, a project of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. Our mission is to inspire, connect, and empower people in order to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. You can learn more about DEF and get involved at DEF.org. That's DEF.org. We look forward to your ideas and are excited to connect you with other doers working on hard problems.
Thank you for coming to DEF. DEF, for those of you who don't know, is a 501c3 nonprofit, and our goal is to inspire, connect, and empower people who are passionate about making change within the national security space. And tonight, your host is going to be Jay Long. And Jay Long is a member of DEF and has been for a couple years now, and he's also a non-resident fellow at the Modern Warfare Institute. And as an innovation officer, he has really kind of started to blossom within the Joint Special Operations Command, the activities and items that they're doing to try to expand capabilities across the range of JSOC officers to include people in command and everyone down to the lowest enlisted level so that they understand the innovation environment. And with that, Jay, I will hand it off to you now that we have finished all the admin.
Good evening, everybody. Thanks for joining us. James, thanks for making the time to chat. And Jen, thanks for hosting. So for those who joined the last session, this is the second step in a continuation of the series attempted to empower digital leadership within the Department of Defense, specifically focused on national security leaders who are driving digital transformation efforts across the joint community. This session is focusing primarily on worldly mapping, a tool designed to show rather than tell digital leaders about a technology to inform their resource investment and development decisions by mapping its sophistication and trajectory to ensure that we're solving the right problem. Tonight's class is going to be taught by James Urquhart. James is the CTO of VMware and has spent over 20 years in the technology space, empowering teams to pursue digital transformation with an emphasis on complex adaptive systems and ensuring that appropriate alignment is occurring between technology teams and their strategy. With that, James, thanks for joining us and looking forward to learning from you this evening.
Well, thank you very much. And it's an honor to be here. And I think the way we'll kind of do this is I'll step through a few parts of telling the story here of what worldly mapping is and kind of demonstrating how to build a map, how you can use a map to make decisions. And I will pause occasionally and we can check to see if there are any questions in QRA or anything like that, Jay, and maybe you can help me with making sure that I don't miss anything there. First, a quick introduction myself. I'm not the CTO of VMware. I'm a field CTO at VMware. We call ourselves now Strategic Executive Advisors. My job is to work with senior leadership, and we do this with everything from the public sector to the private sector, and help them understand and correctly strategize for the ways that they can use modern application development capabilities, modern application platforms, modern infrastructure platforms to improve whatever metric is they're measuring, right? So improve profit for business, improve mission success for DoD, et cetera. As kind of noted, I've got a long background in distributed systems development. I started actually probably pretty close to 30 years ago building even client server before client server was even a known term, really. And have kind of worked in this space of looking at how you can manage increasingly complex applications and systems as the scale of computing that we do grows and as the integration between the systems that we do increasingly makes us one big, happy internet-based system. Although you guys get the air gap stuff, so you guys get a little bit of a pass. So worldly mapping is a technique that I came across quite a while ago. Let me get on the right thing here. So this is Simon Worley. Simon is a gentleman that when kind of early in the days of cloud computing and when I was writing a blog that got a fair amount of traction called The Wisdom of Clouds and there was a small community of bloggers that were similarly kind of beginning to really paint the story of what the value of cloud computing was for or for folks. And we're very active at conferences, very active at, on social media, et cetera. And Simon was a unique character in that he came and said, look, you know, he'd been the CEO of a company, and his job as the CEO was to figure out the strategy for the company. And he realized that he was kind of a fake in it. Like he was just kind of going along and trying to figure out and react to situations and maybe try to copy this guy over here and do what this guy did well, or to, you know, he'd read an article somewhere that said, hey, you should, you know, you should pound desks more in order to get better leadership. Right. And he realized that, you know, all of that stuff wasn't working the way he wanted it to. It didn't kind of sit well with him in terms of actually being a strategy in which he knew where he was going from and where he was going to with some certainty. So he began to think about what it meant. And after quite a bit of investigation and thinking about how he could get some situational awareness about what his opportunities were as a technology company, he kind of hit upon a combination of what Sun Tzu had talked about in terms of the cycle of strategic thinking in The Art of War, and what John Boyd had come up with in terms of the OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, and act, play. And he realized that what he needed to be able to do strategically was to go through this cycle of thinking in order to continuously improve what he was doing. But there were big pieces missing, at least in the tech conversation, and as he realized in most business conversation, in that there's plenty of stuff going on around kind of identifying the purpose and identifying a mission statement that sort of says, this is what we're gonna go out and do, and this is how we wanna go about do it. But there was very, very little out there about these two pieces at the bottom, about identifying your landscape and really putting together an understanding of what are the conditions on the ground today, how are all the different pieces of the market, competition, the technologies that are available to you, the technologies that may come soon that you should be ready for, customer behaviors, you know, all the things that kind of define the situation you're in today and the climate, the things that could that are gonna happen, whether you want them to or not, that are gonna affect what you should be doing strategically. You know, things like, you know, macro market conditions, things like, you know, new technologies or inventions that might change the game in terms of whatever business or whatever organization you're a part of. And so he began to look for what is a really good way for him to be able to pull that stuff together. And so I'm going to start here by telling a story that I think he tells that I think really kind of exemplifies what I just said about the fact that we, when we do technology planning, when we do strategic planning around the use of technology, we don't often make the decision with the right understanding of the landscape of the climate. And that story actually turns out to be a military one. This isn't intentional, not specifically doing this for you guys, but it's something that you got that I think anybody that's a, you know, been trained in the military will understand very, very quickly. You know, Greece 480 BC, you've got this the battle between the Persians and the Athenians. You've got the Themistocles, who's like, there, you know, has to make a decision very quickly about how his small army, about 4,000, if I remember correctly, is going to be able to stand up against an army of 170,000 that's coming its way. And obviously he's got to make a decision. And so what I'm going to do first is say, okay, so how, if you're going to make this decision, which of these tools would you rather have? Would you like to have a map that shows you the movement and the position of the opposing forces, that gives you a opportunity to have conversations, to test different options against that map and begin to identify that maybe there's a unique opportunity here to kind of choke off the opposing forces in the thin straits along the coastline that coming towards Thebes? Or would you rather have a SWOT diagram? Would you rather have, you know, carefully analyze list of the strengths and weaknesses and the opportunities and threats that are out there that are posed for you. And what's really funny is, I think most of you guys, and certainly most of the people that I've seen be asked this question would say, well, in this situation, I'd rather have the map for sure. And then you go, what do most executives use when they make decisions about where to take their business or what technologies to apply to optimize and strengthen their business? And almost always you see something that's closer to that SWOT diagram, right? There's very little situational awareness today. So this is where having a map kind of stands out, is that ability to understand the landscape and the climate. And this is what a Wardley map looks like. And just very quickly, we're going to go through all these different pieces and parts of it. But just to give you an idea, this is a understanding of a set of technologies starting with a user need at the top. And that's really critical. And then the beginning to identify what are the components that you have to have in place to support that user need or set of user needs in this case. So online image manipulation, photo storage, print. And then what are the technologies that are needed in order to support those user needs and those components that supply user need? And you have this vertical axis, which is, I'm going to be really honest with you, it's kind of there just to help you kind of visualize how things come together. There's no value. There's no numerical capability on that axis. It's really about what's the customer going to see versus increasingly what's hidden from the customer or even hidden from the components supporting the customer as you go down lower. So when, by the time you get to power at the bottom there, most people don't know, you know, who the website's power provider is, and the website might not even know who their data center operator's power provider is, right? It's there. It has to be there. And so the map portion of this gets to be a question of starting with that user need as an anchor, as a core position, much like True North is an anchor on a geographical map. You can now begin to get an understanding of the position of these things relative to the anchor from a visibility perspective, and the movement of that activity in terms of how that technology is evolving. Each of those components are evolving over time. And so you have the context, you have position, you have movement, you have components, and you're going to see this more clearly here as I go through, but I just want you to see that this is the basic idea of why we call this a map and not a chart or a graph or something like that. It really is important to understand that movement on the horizontal axis especially, and that positioning gives you information that you can utilize to understand your situation better. So how do you build a map? Start with, again, with that customer need that we talked about. And really, this can be one need or a number of needs, but you want to get an idea of, given a given user or set of users, and I'll show you a map that I made that has actually multiple users here in a bit, but given a user, what are the things that they're looking for in the domain, in the scope of the problem that you're evaluating? And from there, you want to begin to identify what are the other components that have to be in place to support those needs. And so we looked at some of that, right? I may need a customer relationship management thing to handle customer support and payment processing and that kind of stuff. I'll probably need a data center to run things on. I'll need a platform on which to write my custom software and operate it. I'll need computers to run the platform and the other software on, and then ideally all of it's going to need power in order to operate. And then you can say, okay, so how do they come together? And there's a couple ways you can do this. One is, I say, A needs B. That's one way that you can say, hey, there's a link between these components. Another way I like to use this is using something called promise theory. Promise theory basically is an entire algebra around the cooperation of different things in a system based on the concept of a promise. A promise is something that you intend to complete. You intend to, in most cases, you intend to deliver on, but you may not for a number of reasons. So the receiver of that promise may have to take into account that promise will not be fulfilled. So one of the things you can do here is say, instead of A needs B, you can say, what does B promise A? What does power promise to the data center? Right, well, the power component may promise to the data center that there will always be enough electricity in order to meet the demand that the data center is delivering to the compute environment, something along those lines, right? And then power is promising the compute environment that there will always be power available specifically for the circuitry that it's running in order to deliver software, something along those lines. And I haven't been doing a great job of stopping as I go here, but let me just sort of kind of reach the final point with how you take this. So if, once you've kind of identified this kind of graph of user need and this value chain, and this is a value chain in terms of a stack of capability that needs to be in place, and the next thing you can do is begin to evaluate that chain in terms of the evolution of technology. And this is where Simon did something really, really powerful and valuable. What Simon did was say, how do technologies evolve? And is there any consistency to it? And he evaluated about 7 or 8 major technologies, telecommunications, power. I believe he looked at mechanical powers, you know, mechanical devices as well, machines. And I can't remember all the other ones, but I think there was one healthcare one in there. And he looked and said, can I look and see how that technology evolved from the moment that the concept was sort of loosely defined and something interesting was out there, the genesis of the concept, to the point that it becomes so well known and so standard that nobody expects differentiation anymore. They want exactly that capability and feature set in order to deliver the needs that need to be delivered. So you can imagine with telephony, it went from, Mr. Bell, calling his son saying, come in here, all the way through, you know, basically a bunch of hobbyists building devices that could connect together to speak across longer distances and beginning to connect neighborhoods. And then eventually the first telephone companies beginning to build out and the first telephone utilities beginning to build out and kind of running as almost a sort of a product environment where you're purchasing the phones and the focus is less on the service, but becomes increasingly a commodity utility where, you know, by the time any of us were alive, connection via telephones was expected anywhere in this country anyway. And basically the service is a utility, the phones themselves are more or less a commodity. There's some differentiation, but not a lot, right? So this is a really good way of beginning to think, because what his research said, every one of those technology evolutions that he looked at went through some form of evolution with different lengths of time that things were custom or a little bit of a different length of time that things were product, but they all sort of went through these 4 stages as they evolved, and they all had a rapid evolution, relatively rapid evolution once a concept was well enough known that people could build their own and start to do products, to the point where the products become so well defined that it can be offered as a service or it can be mass produced as a commodity. So let's apply that then to our value chain that we did earlier. And this is where that concept of genesis, custom built, product, and commodity become the evolutionary chain that we're looking at. When we evaluate each of these technologies and put them on the map, we want to understand, are these things mostly custom built today? There's really no product you can turn to. Are these things where I can go and buy a library or I can maybe rent a device from somebody to do this, there are vendors out there offering this as a product that I could run in my environment, all the way to the point where you say, you know, this is where cloud has gotten to in the last 10 years, right? It's taken compute, network storage, but also a number of other database services and other software infrastructure services, and said, these are now basically offered as a utility. They're so commodity. Well, you know, a relational database at this point is so well defined at its core that there's not much differentiation between Postgres, MySQL, and and Oracle. They're SQL-driven relational databases with very many of the same capabilities that you would use most often. And so you might as well consider those and as a commodity, in which case, if you offer it as a service, it becomes a utility and it's that easy. So before I get into how I can take this map and now begin to make some very serious decisions, given this information and given this mapping, I'll stop here and ask if there are any questions about sort of how you define a map and what a map's kind of core purpose is.
With that, I see a question from Daniel Holter. Dan, okay. If you want to share that with the group real quick, I saw it in the chat, but if you want to just ask James. And in the event there's any sound issue, James, the question was, there's clear applicability for development of services to government users here. A question that we could extrapolate from that is, where do you think that we could best apply this as military leaders? Obviously, there's not the same market differentiation or market incentives that are defined in the commercial space. So where does this best fit into the defense use case?
Well, the good news is that a couple of different things. So one is, anywhere that you are trying to, you're going to see this in explicitly in a second, by the way. This is a great question, because there's the next step in that circle chain that we kind of talked about was basically this idea of sort of we did this certain kind of landscape and climate piece of it, and we're going to get to doctrine, right? And when you start to apply questions about, you know, what are the smart things you can do with that information, it's really anywhere where you want to understand what's the best use, two questions really, right? So what are some of the best practice things that I can determine I should do from this map? You know, where should I set up teams? Like, how should I divide the technology story into different teams that are delivering different pieces? Where should I outsource some of that technology story versus keep it in my team and custom build something? You know, where should I go find a vendor that delivers something, or even go use, you know, either a defense oriented cloud or a public cloud to deliver the capability, depending on a number of things. And I'll show you some examples of this. There are several things that you can go through and questions you can ask of the map where you can get some very solid pictures of the right way to plan to deliver on that customer need and the right way to divide resources and make investments towards that need. The second place where you can use it is where you're trying to understand where are there opportunities to move the ball in terms of these technologies, to innovate. Where are the innovation opportunities lying, and what sort of technical trends can I anticipate are coming that I can take advantage of in terms of what I'm trying to deliver? And we'll talk about that again. I'm going to give you very specific examples here, but those two kind of key, for me, the key areas are, okay, given the situation that I see on the ground now, I need to make some decisions about the right way to go about solving this problem. A great example of this is, increasingly today, the infrastructure environment that you're going to run your software on is so well defined as a utility, even internally, even in terms of software that you can get that allows you to do self-service deliver consumption of resources within an organization, if that's a necessary requirement. But certainly increasingly now, in terms of the cloud environments that are available to you in the federal level, those environments have become just a really strong, easy way to consume compute resources that get you out of the business of having to manage and maintain all of that. And so being able to determine, okay, which of those services, do I need? Which of those services should I consume from somebody else providing that service to me is a big, big piece of the puzzle. And then the second part being what I said with in terms of being able to do a little bit of predicting the future. And I'll talk about that in a second too. Hopefully that answers the question. We'll get into more detail in just a second on this. Is there another question?
There is actually, and the question I think is potential derivative first, and that is, how does worldly mapping help leaders when the environment they're operating in may, because of artificial reasons, so maybe it's too much regulations or security concerns or litany of non-traditional factors, the evolution of technology within that sphere doesn't keep up with private sector practices. So like if regulations come in there and, or a litany of other like non-true market conditions of this.
Well, I think there's the two parts of that that I would answer. The first is you're going to identify where your inertia is. I actually don't think I have a great example of that, but I'll talk about where there could be a good example before I get out of this. But one of the things you can do with the map, I'll go back to our example map, is you can look, when you look at the evolution of this software, when I get up to the point where I actually do an evolutionary example, I'll be very explicit, but you can actually say, as I map that, hey, say CRM here might be moving to the left, right, in the future, and I can begin to identify that what does that mean if CRM becomes a utility in this situation? I can actually say, well, in my world, I can't go just buy any CRM. I have regulations I have to meet, or I have to use, you know, specific capability in terms of how I interact with the people that are using my software. And so I have an inertia, and then you make a big thick black bar where the inertia is that says, I have inertia that either I have to live with, and it just tells me that I can't evolve this any further. So that's going to affect the way I make my decisions. Or this is an opportunity if I can figure out a way to work with those organizations that are creating that inertia to show them with a Worley map and now other ways that there's huge value in changing that condition so that I can consume something farther to the right. That situation may free up a tremendous amount of both flexibility and agileness for your organization, as well as maybe cost savings for the government overall, right? So budgetary positive effects as well. So you can either do more with the same amount, which is typically what happens, or you could, you know, potentially say, hey, we've been looking for ways to cut costs a little bit. I found a way to do it without cutting headcount. And that happens. That there are several mapping situations where we've been able to identify, you know, some of the stuff we were moving to the cloud was dumb to move to the cloud. We should have kept that in-house for various reasons. And other things that we didn't move to the cloud, there really was no reason not to. And the big thing that I see over and over again is software development teams building their own custom development tool chains and putting together these things, thinking they have a very unique situation in what they have to do in their builds and the compliance environment they have to work through. And then when you map out what their real problem is, you realize that there's a bunch of this stuff that really, and quite frankly, they could just use off-the-shelf components that are already integrated very often in ways to overcome a lot of the same problems they're seeing. And they could use a platform that was set up with their environment, with their regulations, and maybe even their agency in mind, and use that platform in order. So something like Kobayashi Maru, for example, right? You could use that and see from the map that you should be using that, because you're wasting a lot of time building something that's a replica of what's already available to you, right? And so let's move a little bit further. And then I think the questions that are coming up now are partially answered in the remainder of the content here. And we'll come back to more questions in a second. Let's talk about climate. I talk about climate patterns, so those things that change in the map regardless of your actions. They can be economic situation, they can be competitor. You guys don't really have competitors, so let's just say it's, you know, it could be just, policy issues, or it could be sort of international political climate situations that you have to respond to that you have no control over, and you have to take advantage of that. And so some of these things, I'm gonna do this a little bit more from a business perspective, so hopefully, we can get into how to map that a little bit further across to the way the language you would use to describe similar things. But you know, some of this can just simply be that the technologies that you depend on are evolving. So you may be using things today that are software that you install in your own environment, that you manage the servers for, and it may very well be that as some of these air-gapped clouds begin to prove themselves as being secure and reliable, that it would make sense for you to make that move. There are, you know, basically all technologies basically evolve. I mean, it's very, very few things that don't leave some level of where they were from 20 years ago or 10 years ago, or even these days, 2 or 3 years ago. So you want to be able to say, well, what does it mean when this thing that I depend on today that we custom build, that a number of other agencies are custom building their own? Identity is a great example, right? You, almost any government you go into, and to maybe to your surprise, almost any corporation you go into of any significant size in the world will have a dozen identity management systems, right? Even though they're all interacting with more or less the same people, or use doing the more or less the same pattern of stuff, you end up with, you know, I've written my own identity manager and my own authentication system when, frankly, these days, there's really no reason for it. I mean, even if you can't use a utility like an AWS or Azure or GCP to do identity management and use their services, at the very least, there's tons of open source projects and a few that are very, very high up on the list in terms of winners that give you that capability. So that's one thing, is everything moves, and as it moves, that's one set of questions that you can begin to answer with a map, is say, what happens when this moves? Another big thing that you can look at with a map is, as things evolve and become more easy to consume and more readily available, and mostly, most importantly, more predictable in the way that they work, as they evolve that way, they create opportunity to create new things from that technology. So cloud computing, you've seen the explosion of new applications and new services that are being built because the cloud's available. Data is a great example, right? The massive data processing systems are going out there, the AI and machine learning capabilities that are being built today that were frankly pretty impossible to do 10 years ago, or at least 12, 15 years ago. To get the compute capacity and you do this stuff, you had to spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars up front in order to be able to do this. Nowadays, you can go try it out for a while. You can build something out at a smaller scale, decide to shut it down or decide to grow it for a little while, remove that capacity and stop paying for it for a period of time. There's a huge plethora of options in terms of what you can consume, and it's super easy to consume. You don't have to do anything other than request those resources. The example here is, you know, when you look from the early days of the battery to what we have today in terms of the electric grid and the electricity that's available, it's when we started having that ubiquitous 110 volt circuitry available to every home that the business of building radios, of building computing environments, building televisions, those things became viable in a large part because electricity evolved to a point where anybody who wanted to invent something probably had an outlet right next to their workbench and could readily get the power they needed to experiment. And then you could sell it to people that had the outlets they needed that would readily allow them to consume the product that you were selling. And this is another area where I think for what you guys are doing, it's really, a Worley map can be extremely helpful, is in when you look at, you know, how can software affect this mission? One of the things you can ask is, well, if the core pieces that enable that software are becoming more and more commodity, what does that let us do today in terms of new value that we can build on top of those services that weren't there before? And as we harden those services, what new value can be built? Say, you know, you're collecting data of some sort. What new value can be built by consuming that data and analyzing that data in certain ways? Or you're creating an event stream from some set of devices somewhere. What new value could be generated by consuming that event stream and looking for alerts or looking for opportunities to match, supply and demand for some resource or something along those lines. It's a map's a good way to start asking questions. And I want to be really clear, and I haven't said this yet, and I should probably have said it before now. Maps are not perfect charts of what the situation in the world is. You're not going to reach a point where it's indisputable that the map is this way. It's a conversation mechanism, right? It's a, like any other map or any other model, it's incomplete, necessarily incomplete. But if you use a map as the way to get a common visual and a common language about the way that you're going to achieve things, the map can be a really powerful tool for you to get, to get all of your stakeholders on board on the same basic view of what you guys are seeing the world being at that moment. And then you can constantly ask questions of it to kind of get better. This is a map that I made for a technology, and I want to do this to kind of show the predicting the future bit of it a little bit. So this is a map that I made of the pieces and parts necessary to do integration between applications using event-driven approaches. So using an event stream as the method of integrating applications. And so you, the two users are a producer and a consumer. And that flow integration is that, that integration need that I have. I have a need to integrate with real-time data. And so these are all the different pieces that fall over. I'm not gonna go super deep in detail, but what I will point out is that I took a subset of this data and I said, okay, well, all of this stuff today is really important for doing event-driven integration, but a bunch of it is custom built. Discovery is only just now becoming something like, I would maybe move this over to custom built from Genesis maybe today, but it's still, what do we even mean by discovery of event streams? It's just only now getting sorted out in any way. And I asked the question, and you take these things that are kind of and move them left and so that they eventually all become a commodity element, and what does that mean? And to me, my reaction to this when I saw this and did this exercise was like, wow, like if you make event-driven integration a super simple, anybody can do it, the interfaces are fully defined so that you know exactly what interface you need to call to create a connection to any stream that might be out on the internet or within your agency or whatever it is. And there are libraries available to make the connections super easy. You just have to say, hey, I want to connect to the stream, and everything's taken care of for you. The protocols are well known so that, you know, maybe the only thing you really need to do is go look up how to read the payload, but all the metadata about the event, the context, the time it happened, where it came from, all the data provenance about who touched that event since it was initially signaled, all of that stuff is included in it. If that stuff is all really well defined and super standard, it makes the cost of integration, real-time data integration, go down by orders of magnitude. It's got a super huge impact on the way we're going to integrate applications in the future. And so by doing this map and asking this question, you know, basically you'll see at the end, I'll provide a link for it, but I'm writing a book about this concept of flow and flow architectures and this concept of integrating by event-driven applications, because I think the map showed to me and set me on a path of exploring this immense impact that I believe that we're gonna see from this evolution that's occurred. Now, to that question that came earlier about, well, what happens if I can't quite do that in that movement because there's something that says I can't go to a public cloud to do X? That's fine. I would, you know, I put a thick black bar wherever it, I felt like it best in best let people know where that resistance was coming from and note what that black bar is about. But then when I have a conversation about that map later with senior officers or with other agency or other organizations that I'm trying to integrate with, or that my customers that I want to consume the service that I'm offering, I can make clear that, you know, we'd really love to be able to consume this as a commodity component or as a cloud utility. We can't for regulatory purposes right now. So this is why we're here in terms of the way we do things. And that would hopefully give you the opportunity to trigger the conversation about, you know, what are the ways that we could overcome that inertia, or is it not a big deal? Could be that the inertia is fine. That's cool. You know, everything runs really well. It runs cost effective enough. We're able to achieve our mission without having to make that movement. So this is an idea of sort of, you know, the ways that you can begin to ask questions to predict the future. What Simon did with this was he was doing a photo sharing application, was the company that he was the CEO of, and it was a photo sharing website. And he discovered that there was this huge opportunity to change the developer platform. That platform was all custom. And, you know, back in the late 90s when he did this evaluation. And so he said, what happened if we kind of explored creating a commodity platform for ourselves? And maybe, you know, would that be valuable to others? And before he sold the company to Canon, they had created what is arguably the first platform as a service offering on the internet, which was this thing called Zimki. And Zimki basically allowed you to write JavaScript functions and write applications as sets of JavaScript functions that they would execute in their environment for you. It wasn't as powerful as what's out there today. He'll be readily tell you that, you know, there's a lot of evolution that was left to do with it. Of course, you know, he sold Zimki to Canon because they wanted the photo sharing capability, and they killed the Zimki story relatively quickly after the acquisition. So we never got to see it go very far. But he uses that as an example of the fact that they didn't have good situational awareness. What they were mostly concerned with back then was 3D displays, right? So they put their kind of eggs in that basket instead of looking at what AWS is doing now, which is this massive business. Okay, before I get into doctrine in more depth, are there any kind of questions about sort of those ways of kind of looking at the climate and looking at opportunity to take advantage of things that are going to happen with technologies and that you can maybe even drive forward with technologies?
Two questions have come up so far, okay. James. One of them is, if you have a boss who's more interested in quantitative versus qualitative feedback, how do you use a Worley map as a starting point to build your business case for why, even though the positions are relative, the underlying logic is strong enough to justify a pivot and strategy?
Yeah, I think the fun with Worley maps is you always have to teach people what a Worley map is before you walk them through it, right? I think what's really important there is it works incredibly well as a tool to say, essentially, this is where we are. And as I show you some of the doctrine stuff, this is what the map would tell us is the right thing to do for the following reasons. And this is where things are going. So these are the things that we should be prepared for. And so this is where we should focus our attention as we begin to quantify what's the right point of execution we should do, right? So let's not waste our time over here with this thing, you know, with this concept of building this thing, because we really shouldn't be building it. Let's not waste our time with this technology because it's getting replaced by this other technology as we speak, right? Let's focus our attention over here because this has the long-term potential to create new value and new effects. It's a starting point for a strategic discussion. It's not a tactical tool. It's not a very good tactical tool. It's a really good conversation for, hey, we should focus our attention here and then to use the techniques that you would use with a manager, with a leader to sort of say, okay, so, you know, if there's agreement that this is where we should focus our attention and if the maps helped us make those decisions, then, okay, now we have to do our evaluation about what's the right way to make these investments based on those observations.
Second question we had come up is the current template that we saw at the X-axis seems to be primarily oriented on technology. Have there been people that have tried it with like culture, team formation, storming and norming, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go on the internet, there is a tremendous amount of stuff out there that there's actually an annual event in London called Map Camp where people come back and present this what they've been doing with maps. Just in the last 2 years, I'll give you some examples. There's a gentleman that's figured out an interesting way of mapping the political situation within a group or an organization using a Worley map-like approach. And so you can get an idea of a little bit of an idea of sort of the relationships between people, but not only that, what is somebody trying to shift something in a certain direction towards more control, more consolidation, and what happens if you change the relationships a little bit? Does that affect the way that movement happens? Culture is something that Simon himself has spent a lot of time on lately. He's just now, if you go to his blog, not the link I'll show you here later, although you can get to his blog from that link. But on his blog, he's been talking a lot about culture and mapping culture and what it means. And one of his big observations is since nobody can define culture crisply and concisely, by itself, mapping culture is a very, very difficult and arbitrary thing to do. However, you can map the critical, the critical, crux of the ways people communicate and the values that people have in that organization, in that group, kind of on a more detailed level. And you can get a better sense from that of ways that you can move something from, I don't remember what the scale is, unfortunately, I apologize for that, but I think it's along the lines of, you know, moving it from being controversial to being accepted. And you can get a look at where maybe it's more important to put effort into one area than another area along with that. But, you know, he'll point out that, you know, the culture mapping stuff can be used for good or evil. And, but it's definitely worth reading and understanding a little bit about what he's been talking about and doing there. One of the really interesting things is that Simon works for the Leading Edge Forum, which is a think tank that's kind of an international leadership, technology leadership think tank. And they've been doing a lot of work with governments across Europe and Asia. Not China, thank God. But they've been doing a lot of work in terms of understanding some specific policy and mapping policy a little bit more and doing evaluation about what's the right way to move policy. And so he's done everything there from, you know, looking at nuclear power policy, looking at healthcare policies, and doing some interesting mapping along those lines. And again, those four categories at the bottom are, you're right, those are very technology kind of oriented. But he finds that a four category map, you can put a number of other terms underneath there for different situations. And in some past presentations, I've had a slide that shows like, you know, a map with like five or six different categories of stuff underneath in those four categories for data, for mapping data, for mapping policy, for mapping human relationships, and so on. So there's a lot more you can do with it. There was another question too?
Not yet.
Okay, all right. So let's talk about doctrine real quick. And I know I wanna be aware of everybody's time here, but we'll kind of move through this. What's really interesting here is that Simon and you know, the number, I've known Simon for a very, very long time, and I've actually helped contribute to some of this. We have sort of collected a set of things that can be practices that can be applied to an organization and thought of in terms of applying to a map that can move, basically help move the bar in terms of the evolution of various technologies. And help improve the way that an organization works given its current situation. And so, you know, some of these are really kind of very straightforward. The highlighted ones are ones that he talks about in a little bit more depth and in a couple of blog posts. From my perspective, I'm going to talk about a few in some very, very tight, small detail given the time frame that we have. Again, his book, that I'll give you the link to. It's actually a set of Medium posts. Has much, much more detail on this. And I encourage, if this sounds interesting to you, to go do some more reading. This is the area where I find the most value, is being able to sort of say, what happens if we were to say, you know, build a moat around our company's technology? Does that help us in our map, or does that hurt us in our map? Is it a way of overcoming competitive pressure? Is it a way of overcoming inertia? And being able to ask questions in terms of, these are standard ways of looking at the way that your organization can attack technology, not only technology, but attack any given problem in a certain level, then you get a lot of value. So let me give you an example. So this is one that actually has several of those doctrines applied to it, this map. So it's the same map we were looking at before, but there's a couple of things that should be really pulled out. So there's that grouping, that amoeba shape that you see across the map. What does that mean? Well, those are ways of sort of looking at and having a conversation about the way to organize teams around addressing the problem. So if I want to move, say, my platform from being where it is today to being, you know, I want to disrupt the market by building something that's a utility platform, yes, there's some inertia. There's those black bars I was talking about. Yes, there's some inertia. The product companies are not going to want me to offer what they sell on a license basis as a, you know, as a per use utility, but that's an opportunity for me potentially of doing something. That way of kind of breaking down and looking at these things are very related to each other. Can we group it this way? Can we group it that way? Should we build teams in the following way is a really good way of using a map to help understand how to organize to solve the user need that you're seeing. The second thing that I'll point out is the different color circles around the dots. So you have, you know, you have these black dots around the stuff that's all the way over in the commodity utility side. So one of the things he's got that it says is like, okay, in those situations, we want to basically outsource that completely to utility suppliers, maybe, you know, the public cloud providers in some way, or maybe the internal cloud providers that you have for the DoD. We don't, there's no reason for us to run that. And power is always a great example. You know, you're not going to run your own generators to run your software systems, right? You're definitely going to outsource that. You may want to outsource increasingly large numbers of stuff like compute, and maybe even your development platform, just utilizing something like Cloud Foundry or OpenShift or something to basically give you a very commodity consistent way of delivering the standard application types that you're delivering out the door. You also notice that there's circles there that don't have lines around them. The gray circles without lines represent things that then you're like, okay, well, we can buy off the shelf products and install them in our environment and basically use sort of a experimental lean technology towards figuring out how to put those together to those pieces of the puzzle, add those to the solution. And then finally, you may need to build custom software in-house. And when you do that, then you can identify that these are the areas that we really want our developers to be focused on building technology. And this is where we want to make the investment on the talent and the time necessary to deliver on that. And we may want to use much more agile sort of approaches, right? Being able to do very high iterative development and utilize the value you get from the stuff farther to the right in order to be able to do things faster and having less work on your part to make sure there is a platform, make sure there are computers, make sure there is a website. You know, in this example, that's able to deliver what you want to deliver. The last part that I'll, so the next point I want to point out is this idea with the colors of the amoeba shapes. There's an idea of putting different types of talent on different problems as well. So when you have to invent something and you have to kind of sort out the mess and the problem and the, and be a little bit, you know, be a little bit sort of messy and less structured in order to quickly get to a solution. It takes a certain kind of personality to do that. So the idea of having a, you know, a pioneer, somebody who's really wants to play around with an experiment and doesn't mind being wrong a lot on the way to being right. That's a situation that's great for that custom stuff. It's less good for anything you might be running, either as a service you're offering outwards to others, or any of the software that you install in your environment and want to have running in your environment. In those situations, you may find yourself saying, "I need somebody a little different. I may need somebody to take something that I've invented and productize it, meaning." Industrialize it a little bit, make it more capable of being replicated, of being offered with SLA terms to outside customers, or I just need to make sure it's more bulletproof for my organization to consume. And so taking that kind of inventive stuff and beginning to put that together into something that's more structured and product-like and has a backlog, has a vision for what it wants to be in the future, then you may want somebody that's a little bit more like me. I mean, I'm clearly a settler in terms of my personality. I like to take the really cool concepts that the crazy out there people come up with and figure out how to productize that and make that something that is highly replicable for an organization. Then you get to the stuff where, like, look, when we run this stuff, we know exactly how it should run. And we know exactly, we're measuring statistically the quality by which it runs, because it's got to be there, it's got to be available, it's got to be predictable in the way it behaves. And so we want to be very controlled in how we modify it, because if we modify it and really mess something up, it has a massive impact on the environment. We want to be very, very, very structured. We know it slows down the rate of progress that's going to happen because of that. But we want somebody who's going to be there and dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's, and where failure is something that we want to try to avoid a little bit more. And we want to be able to recover from failure extremely quickly when it does happen. And in those situations, you want somebody that's a little bit more of sort of that highly organized person who keeps to-do lists and keeps a very strong, you know, architectural map of what's going on in their environment, checks the charts every day to see if there's any anomalies from the running of the environment, right? Somebody who's very much kind of focused, and we call those town planners, which is an incredibly important trait to have. I used to sit in on AWS operations calls when I worked there, and you had all of this mix. You had people who were coming in and saying, yeah, you know, I'm doing this highly experimental thing. So we tried this and we tried that. And yeah, they didn't work out, but we, you know, they didn't affect customers because we didn't have any customers. We're just trying to invent this service and figure this out. And then you had people on the other, on the scale who said, okay, after 2 weeks of planning, we made this change to this feature and we measured A/B testing of the old feature versus the new feature. And we're able to say statistically that we get a 4% improvement in the consumption of the service with the new feature versus the old feature, right? So it gives you kind of the idea of that spectrum of different personalities that are involved. So that's another thing you can do with the map. The fourth thing that is that you see that bucket up there that says plus worth, right? This goes back to that idea that once you move something and improve and create something that becomes really easy to consume and reduces the cost of doing whatever that consumption is, like I talked about with the flow integration thing, reducing the cost of integrating applications with real-time streams by orders of magnitude. Once you do that, you create the opportunity for entrepreneurs and inventors and people with unique problems to sit there and very, very freely experiment and play around with what's available to now with this new environment and these new lower cost economics. And new value inevitably gets generated from all that experimentation. It may be massively inefficient in how we find that value, but once that value is found, it's well worth it, right? Once that value is found, then it may change the game. It may create a new platform, like television was created from electricity, create a new platform that creates all kinds of new value, like all the content we created for television and sort of all the different channels of everything we do now, and the value of YouTube that was driven by the television model for a while, right? All of those things kind of come off of doing well with building off of something that's moved into that that easy to consume utility space. So that's another thing you can do with a map is identify, like, you know, is there opportunity for us to take these things that were just made available to us that changed the economics of running whatever our mission is? Can we do something brand new and powerful at a much more reasonable cost? Can we experiment where it wasn't cost effective to experiment before? And what are the possibilities here? And it's impossible to predict what will come out of that bucket. You know, when I say you can predict the future with a map, you know, trying to predict exactly what new technologies will be invented from old technologies, that doesn't work. But predicting that there will be new technologies that come out of this and that there's a good opportunity to explore and experiment can be predicted. Before I move on to the next slide, any questions about all of that? That was sort of a whole bunch of stuff on one map, but I thought it was a really good way to kind of give you an idea of the power of expression that's here. And this is all just situational awareness of a little bit of future predicting in terms of saying what happens if we move platform and compute over. But mostly, most of this is largely about just what my current situation is and how I can better organize and better plan for the way that user need gets fulfilled.
One question is, when you're looking at teams and organizational cultures, right? Obviously, the Department of Defense is known for being comparatively bureaucratic versus, say, a Silicon Valley startup. How much of this is individual personality based? And so even in a bureaucracy, you can have the mobility. And how much should a leader recognize that there's inherent constraints within normal organizational bounds, and therefore they may need to make different decisions?
Yeah, there's a few ways that this can get addressed. So one thing is, if you, you know, and I'm not going to try to sell you on this now, but if you buy into this concept that there are these personalities, differences and different types of software development that you're doing, then one of the things you can think of as a leader is, am I organized well so that the people with the right personalities are able to do the right tasks, right? Have I identified who my best pioneers are? Have I identified who my best town planners are? Have I correctly built a culture that recognizes the value of all of them, right? And that's something where a lot of leaders fall short, is they don't really value the town planners because they're just keeping that thing that's a cost center running, right? And so they become another part of the cost center, as opposed to seeing, man, if I get a really efficient one and I don't need a bunch of other staff to support that person, they can, you know, one operator can handle 5,000 servers instead of 500, right? Then you can begin to understand that there's a real good reason to recognize those people and keep those people around. I think there's a really good point made though in that second part, which is, it's also good for evaluating realistically the team that I have today. Are they, two questions. One, are they the right team for the mission that I have? You know, am I supposed to be building a whole bunch of custom software development and I don't have any really good software developers on the staff at all that kind of can do that invention kind of stuff? Or given the nature of what I have, how does that affect the decisions about what strategies I pull from this map, right? If I'm heavily, you know, I've got a team that's essentially really good at taking instruction, but they're not really good at inventing ways around problems, it's going to say a lot about how much software development you should do, period. Like what kind of software development problems you should take on at all. Like integrating products that solve problems in known ways, or you know, maybe at worst, kind of taking an open source project and doing some customization of an open source project to solve a problem. Those things are probably fine with an organization like that. But inventing something brand new that's game changing with a team that's not really good at that, you can begin to get a sense of that from this. So, I definitely think, there's a lot of stuff that the Defense Department does that that we civilians hear about that are, you know, very, very interesting, difficult, very real time, very immediate need problems that have a lot of brand new ways of looking at using technology to solve them, using satellite technology, using, radar technologies, whatever it may be. And in those situations, like creating that kind of stuff, right? That's to me why when you go all the way left on the chart, that's where DARPA comes in, right? That's why you have the staff you have at DARPA to do that kind of stuff. You don't need to be DARPA necessarily, but you might want to work with them. You might want to say, hey, for this problem, we better start partnering with somebody that can do that stuff. But on the other end of the scale, right? There's a lot of software development out there that needs to be done that is integrating known components and making sure that some decisions are made by taking data streaming from this, applying some algorithm to it, and then signaling these other things or running this report or whatever it may be that comes out the other side. And that stuff to me, that's settler stuff pretty easily, right? You don't need a high intensity computer science background, you know, understands the difference of different orders of operation kind of person to do that kind of work. You can do that with soldiers that have, you know, a year or two of training and have some help in the basic understanding of how to do the integration. So that's just some ways of kind of looking at this.
One quick follow-on question. Based on that response, is there a relationship between skill and mastery and where somebody is on the trajectory? And by that, I mean, I would imagine that for somebody to truly invent and use DARPA, there's also pioneers, they need to kind of master the craft to know how to invent something new. The same way a PhD is inventing new knowledge after going through a lot of schooling. Do people usually shift and or can you train your team to operate in different spaces? Or do you think that's usually more anchored based on personality type?
Well, getting into the area where I'm not going to claim to be an expert in terms of human psychology, right? But my experience is, there are people who love to tinker there are people who love to create and scale something, take something super interesting and bring it to more people. And there are people who really like to just kick ass on execution of something that is well known. And there's some overlap. So yes, people can, there are people who bounce back and forth between being a pioneer and a settler, I think quite often that in the startup world, absolutely the case. I think there are people, plenty of people who bounce back and forth between being town planners and settlers as well. People who say, I want to take something that's just starting to show signs of what it means to be industrialize it, and then squeeze the hell out of the efficiency of that. So I think those things are true. So the truth is, people may land in your organization being assigned a job that's really a settler job, but you discover in the course of working with them that, man, they spent a lot of time kind of trying to figure out how to use this brand new technology that came out of nowhere to build a feature that, you know, and define a feature and try to get it on the backlog that nobody asked for initially, but that's really cool, right? You're going to discover people that are tinkerers that came in as settlers. You're going to discover people that get assigned to an operations team that's really, you know, operating something that's very, very well defined, that desperately want to create the next new thing. Okay, so they're probably, put them on a settler team for a while, right? I think it's more likely that you're going to hire somebody in, or somebody's going to be assigned to a position where they're not a perfect fit, where you could identify that and say, hey, you know, we've got this other thing going on over here, but let me recommend you to this other officer as maybe a good person on their staff, because the stuff they're doing is probably much more interesting to you than what we're doing. But I don't think generally there's a whole bunch of, you know, people bounce around from one to the other based on the day of the week. People have a personality. They want to work in certain areas. They may overlap a couple of these, but I tell you what, if you put me on a town planner position where I just had to sit there and keep track of all the data every day and identify every little thing that I need to attack next to squeeze efficiency out of the system, you'd lose me pretty quickly. It would not be my favorite job. But there are people I know who would just rock at it and love it. So, anything else? Any other questions?
Not yet.
All right. Well, that's mostly the presentation. I do want to give you some resources that you can use if I've sparked your interest at all with this, if you want to kind of understand a little bit more in depth. I definitely recommend medium.com/worldlymaps, pretty straightforward URL. That's Simon's book, 19 chapters of stepping through from how he came across the concept and the problems he was trying to solve, all the way through very, very complex, detailed ways of using maps and doctrine. Not just maps, right? He looks at doctrine, he looks at, looks at pioneer, settler, town planner, he looks at a number of other things as ways of taking strategy based on having that situational awareness. What are some of the things that people can do to kind of take forward? If you want a good sort of fairly quick and dirty, I think it's 45 minute long presentation that he did for InfoQ 1 year, Crossing the River by Feeling the Stones. He's a great presenter, absolutely wonderful presenter, lots of humor, lots of just very, very well presented learning in his presentation. I highly recommend taking some time out of your day to look at that. And then finally, the final piece is I'll just pump my forthcoming book here a little bit. I do a fair amount of worldly mapping in it. One of the things I do that may be of interest to folks is I talk about applying promise theory when you do your value chain maps. I do that in the book as well. And then I also talk about another technique that I could come back and talk about at some other time called event storming, as a way of identifying the flow of information through a problem set that you're looking at and beginning to identify what the value chain is just by talking to people about how things work today, how things could work, should work optimally, and beginning to give you the basis to build the value chain, which you can then use. You can also identify the promises in the value chain through that technique as well. So it's kind of a good way to get a group of people to arrive at the same value chain at the same time. So I talk a little bit about that in the book as well. So with that, I happy to answer any other questions or talk, about where I've seen maps applied or whatever you guys have with any time that's left over. But I appreciate your time and I hope you got a lot out of this.
First, James, thanks for sharing. And as everybody populates the Zoom chat with any remaining questions, one thing I'd ask you is, what organizations have you worked with that have leveraged this tool exceptionally well? And what do you think was different about their application of this than, say, the average person who may read an article and play around with the concept?
Yeah, I think one area that where we used it recently that had an amazing effect was at, let's just say, a large manufacturer of flying things in Seattle. They had some honest questions about how to organize to better improve their software development techniques and to get more factory-like in the way they were producing software. And so they built a map of what they thought the ideal would be. They actually started with what's the ideal value chain first. And once they did that, they went back and mapped what's the current situation? What do we believe is the current situation? And what came out of that was a very strong identification of where they should focus resources to get towards that ideal state. And including some surprises, like things that they thought they were going to have to custom develop, they realized that that was ridiculous. They should either buy it off the shelf or consume a public cloud to do that. So there were several situations where there were some political implications from it, right? Organizations that were like, hey, we need to build this and we've got the best people in the industry to do this and we're super sharp, and just identifying, guys, it's great, except it doesn't make sense for us to do it. It makes more sense for us to have an outside vendor do it. So that's one area. I have done this, I've done Morley mapping with some organizations in terms of identifying what they're custom building today, and asking solid questions about should they be custom developing stuff, and then once we've sort of validated and rationalized what their current portfolio look like, then asking questions about are they staffed well, or do they have the right people working on them, that was extremely helpful for an upper level, a senior level management conversation that had to happen after that about, about their current organization and whether they were well organized for agile software development or not, whether their own organization was blocking the ability for them to adopt agile software development techniques. So that was really good. And as I say in my book, and I've done this on some blog posts I have as well. I map technology spaces all the time that I'm interested in. And every once in a while I come across a gem like, wow, if we do this real time event driven integration and become super cheap, super easy, like HTTP did for information, we'll link the world's activity, through flow. And so, that's another area where it's been really good. We don't do it as a regular thing with every customer we talk to, in part because it's better at a manager level conversation when there's a strategy question on the line. And so I will talk about Worley mapping and the ability to map problems and the kinds of solutions you can find when I start running across somebody who says, we know we need a solution to this problem, but we have no idea about what the best way is to go about developing it. I'll usually say, well, the first thing you need to know is what's the situation today? What's your situational awareness? of what technologies you have in place that would play into this or not. And we'll do some mapping there.
Super helpful. I've got a lot of people thanking you for your time in the Zoom chat. Personally, I want to thank you for coming on tonight for context. You're able to speak to members of pretty much all the services. So thanks for sharing the wisdom and insight. I'm really excited to share your book and then this podcast and also the video that's coming out soon. One final question. Is there anything you haven't had the chance to share yet that you want to make sure those listening capture, or any like final nuggets of wisdom that you want to pass on to those listening?
Yeah, you know, there's one other thing that's not in the presentation that I would say people might want to take a look at in the book as well, which is if you have groups of different projects, or even groups of people that have different opinions about the way to map a certain value chain, or you have a lot of overlapping use of services among multiple projects, and you want to kind of see how each one sees it. There's also a technique that Simon talks about basically, you know, sort of collecting all of the different points on the map that people think things are, and then looking at what that tells you in terms of a number of things. So if you have a whole bunch of projects saying, yeah, this is commodity at this point, and you have one project that says, we do this custom, right? That's a really good, like, hey, that's an outlier. That's maybe something that we should go explore and see what the deal is there. If you have a really spread out timeline where there's a whole bunch of custom, but there's also people who think that we're beginning to get close to that commodity phase, we're in product maybe, but we're getting closer, whatever. That's a really good opportunity to sit down as a bunch of organizations that have a similar problem and have a real conversation about, is there a service here that some team somewhere should be offering that would eliminate a whole bunch of work that you guys are taking on that doesn't need to be taken on? Is there an opportunity to standardize at this point in time around this problem? And the answer could go either way. You could find out, you know what, wow, there's a lot of really different problems, and what we're calling one component, maybe there's categories of components and we should think about each category differently. Or you may find out that, yeah, there's a huge opportunity here. We have some development teams that are struggling like crazy with the things that other development teams take for granted, because the first development team didn't know what that second development team was taking advantage of to be able to do so. And there's a real opportunity here for us to attack that problem and get everybody kind of on the same page. So that's another area that I think is really worthwhile. And I would just say, you know, the number one thing to get started with the map is just to make one. Just to pick a problem, sit down with yourself or with a few people and try it out. The only way that I know people have gotten quote unquote good at mapping or really confident in the map is telling them something valuable is by doing it a few times. And the people that I read are doing mapping in much more depth than even I am, they will tell you that they learn something almost every time they do a map, especially for any new situation that they get into. They learn something new about something that they thought they knew a lot about in the past. And so I just encourage that. Well, that I'll close with that. I think that's the right
place. Well, perfect. And with that, everybody, first, James, again, thanks for your time and help. Everybody joined us. Thanks for checking in. We'll be sharing this soon. I believe, James, if they wanted to ask you any additional questions, can they tag you on LinkedIn or anything of public business?
Yeah, you know, a really good way to reach me is on Twitter, where I'm just at James Urquhart. All one word. I'm fairly active on there. If you let me know that you'd like to DM me, if you can't DM me already, if you just let me know that you want to, that's a really good way to reach me. I'm a little bit less active on LinkedIn, but I do check LinkedIn on a regular basis. So if that's your preferred way of reaching out, absolutely let me know. I have been actively, when I see people are part of the defense community and they're reaching out to connect with me, I've been actively making sure I accept those invitations. I'm pretty picky on invitations usually, but you guys seem all right. and so from that perspective, I'm happy to communicate on LinkedIn as well. And then my email address is just first initial last name, jurquhart@vmware.com. And I'll also very happy to have an email conversation with anybody that would like to get more in depth on something.
Awesome. With that, everybody, James, thanks so much. Have a great night. Stay healthy.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great night.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. We love ideas and feedback, so feel free to send your thoughts to hello@deaf.org. For more great content and to stay in the loop about community events and activities, follow us on social media and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. Everyone plays a part in building the innovative national security culture we want to see. To find where you fit, just go to deaf.org/join. That's def.org/join.